Well, yeah, thank you for joining me. I really, I'm really excited that mindfulness, I think Gaynor Yancey came up to me and she said, mindfulness is having its moment. And it's true. I was at NACSW last year, and there's one workshop, and I mean, it's been around. It has been around, but to be here at NACSW and see this interest, I'm really just very excited. I think what I hope I can sort of give you all is this, just thoughts about mindfulness and also some practical tools that you can walk away with. And so I'm going to try to do a lot of things in a short amount of time, so I apologize. I won't do justice for each one, but I do want to first really define mindfulness, kind of the thinking that I've done, especially I'm a doctoral student at Baylor, but I teach at Azusa. I've been a clinical social worker for over a decade, and just the thinking that goes along with all that, I want to share those thoughts. I want to give credit to Lisa Hosak, too. What I thought was really interesting about her workshop is that I didn't know much about her work and what she's been doing, but I went to her workshop, and what she's kind of thought about is so similar. And we didn't share notes. We didn't talk. And so I think we're onto something when we talk about this Christian integration of mindfulness. So the fact that you're two separate people kind of doing this work, we're coming to similar conclusions, I hope will be sort of encouraging for you. I also want to lower the standards of expectations about this quantitative study that I'm still in the middle of. I have very, very preliminary results. I don't have anything worthy of any kind of real implications just yet, but I think there will be. So I do hope, I want to put that out there, and because I'm still in the middle of it, and I'm excited about what's happening and the numbers I'm getting, but I just want a few more numbers. So those are my qualifiers. I'm hoping that we can, you know, do discussion and all that too. So please feel free to interrupt me at any point. I'm happy to answer or clarify. Okay? I'm Regina. I teach at Azusa. I teach field, which I think is a lovely way to keep one's foot in the practice, in the practice world. And then I get to do the research. So I really enjoyed mindfulness because it's allowed me to do that. Okay, so two definitions of mindfulness. First, it really is a theoretical philosophy that comes out of Buddhism. So in Buddhism, there's lots of different schools of Buddhism. So I want to be clear. When I talk about Buddhism, it's like talking about Christianity. There's so many different schools, so many different lenses. But so I'm going to paint with a broad brush and just say that mindfulness comes out of the Eightfold Path. Okay, so out of the Eightfold Path is a concept called mindfulness. And this is the definition that I've sort of offered. It's hard to translate these things, as you know, because first of all, these are like Eastern religious traditions, either in Japan or China, and these words don't always translate well. But it is about present moment attention, non-judgment, observation. And so the way we've defined it in America, I think, is a little different than if you were to go to Thailand, or if you're a Zen Buddhist in Japan, or if you're a Mahayana Buddhist in China. And I won't go into those details, but I'm happy to answer those questions because I've done some religious studies in those traditions as well to kind of compare and contrast. It's a theoretical concept, but it's also a practice. And so that's really the rub. You know, when you get a philosophy and then you turn it into a practice, there's a lot of questions that come out of that. But I do want to say that I think what mindfulness in general offers is a practice that we can both use professionally and personally as social workers. I think it's powerful, and the results are in the literature, and I'll share those with you next. I do want to stop there, though, first and ask if you have any questions, particularly about these first concepts, this sort of theoretical religious philosophy versus this practice. Okay, we're comfortable with that?
Yes. A little bit about the Eightfold Path.
Yes. Yeah, so in Buddhism, and it depends kind of if you're, there's two traditions, Theravada Buddhism, which is more Southeast Asia. So we're talking about Thailand, Laos, Cambodia. And then you have Mahayana Buddhism, which is Japan and China and Korea. And so they'll tell you different things. But the Eightfold Path is the way to, they wouldn't call it salvation, they call it nirvana. But it's enlightenment. But that is the path. So it's things like kindness, mindfulness, right thinking, right behavior. So it's, again, it's a religious philosophy. It really anchors the behavior part of the religion. I can go into that more, but even if you Google search an image, Eightfold Path, you'll get this really cool image that kind of shows you this wheel of how Buddhists think about the path to nirvana. Yes.
So some Christians are uncomfortable with practices that emerge from other religious traditions.
Yes.
I don't know, is that something you're going to get to later?
I'm going to get into that.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm going to say that Christians, we have a very ancient tradition that we can draw from. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to choose this path, but
sure.
People do often choose this path in clinical social work.
Sure.
But as Christians, I think, you know, we can decide what we want to do. I'm not going to tell you what that means, you know, what you should do. Kind of going back to Helen Harris's, I'm not going to tell you the shoulds. I'm just going to tell you the questions and,
sure.
and the principles. So here's a scattering of research. I mean, I could go on. If you went to Lisa Hosek's presentation as well, she had a list of folks, and she did this nice engram of showing in Google search, if you put in mindfulness, how in the last 10 years, it's the research has sort of just exploded. But really, just talking about, I'm going to put it under emotion instead of just mental health, but neurological studies have been done, and that really shows how mindfulness can help improve attention, attunement, concentration, decision-making capacity, which, as you can think about as social workers, if you're in the heat of a moment, you've got 10 cases that you've got to see. If you can do a mindful practice, if it can help you with concentration and attention, that can be really helpful. DBT, CBT, and BCT stand for dialectical behavioral therapy. That comes out of Marshall Linehan's work. I'm sorry, that should say ACT, not CBT. ACT instead of CBT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, as well as mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. These things have been shown to be useful in a variety of conditions, stress, particularly depression, anxiety, OCD, PTSD. These are some of a smattering of references, and I have a list of references at the end of the PowerPoint I can share with you as well. DBT, especially, which if we think about borderline personality, I was talking to Christine earlier about how difficult that can be. Eating disorders, we've talked about that. But yes, these are some of the, especially the complex mental health issues that DBT has been kind of more effective than other things. So I find that very exciting. And then just again, practically for us as social workers, in prevention of burnout, I went to a workshop early about resiliency and that kind of connection with mindfulness and increasing capacity to take on a lot of stress and to be resilient in our work. And again, there's just a couple references out of many. I mean, I would have 4 or 5 slides for you if I included everything. Okay, so what are some practices? We talked about a little bit of the theory coming out of Buddhist thought. I'm going to get into the more of the Christian thought soon, so don't worry. But I want to say it's very practical. I just wanted to share a very simple example of what I would call a mindful practice. So on particularly stressful days in practice or before the classroom at Azusa Pacific University, which never happens, right? Never. I make a mug of tea, and I'll carry that with me to the classroom. And in that mug, I just hold it, and I picture myself, and I'm like this mug, and I'm like, God, you are holding me. And I can feel the warmth, and I can feel your presence. And then as I sip the tea, I can feel that sensation. I can feel the warmth of the liquid going down my throat and into my stomach, and I receive your grace. I receive what I need from you today. And I can do all of that in 2 minutes. And it's just a quick practice that just kind of, for lack of a better term, really centers me. And that's just one quick example I wanted to share, but it is practical. It can be done in any setting. Imagine yourself at a hospital, you know, and you've got lots of situations you've got to tell a family member bad news. You know, this is something that you don't have to take out a book and look at the DSM-5 and get your workbook out and try to figure out what kind of treatment plan. This is what I think is helpful with mindfulness, is you can access it anytime. I'm not going to go through each of the biblical texts here, just for sake of time, because I do want to open up to questions. But these are some texts that I think about when I think about some of these other practices. Deep breathing, it just, that's the verse that talks about God formed man, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And just, you know, the Psalms, it's about being mindful in his presence and his love. But there's so much, I think, in the Bible that really can help us think about and not just meditate, but really be attentive to our faith and can be enfolded in our practice, whether, again, personally or professionally. Any questions there? I just want to stop. Anyone have something similar that you could think about, like my mug of tea? Yes.
I think on days in practice when I'm really rushing from client to client or situation, taking a moment to, it sounds so silly, but going to the bathroom and really mindfully washing my hands and just like, you know, sort of absorbing like, oh, this is nice pink soap. it's just a very physical process and a very grounding process.
Absolutely.
And it's necessary to do after you go to the bathroom.
yeah. But you made it into that nice thing.
Thank
you for sharing that. I don't think that's silly at all. I think that's great. And yes.
I think that when I think about mindfulness and the results that it does, sometimes my mind says, well, why doesn't just prayer do that for me? Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is because when I pray, all the different things come to my mind that I want to ask for. And it makes me even a little bit more anxious. Mm. Now, I have to then give all of those things, but it can be a long process because I think about a lot of things all at once.
Right.
And so, to me, that's the difference between just prayer in general, if it's a asking kind of prayer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when I start asking for one thing, then I think of asking for a lot of things, and then it's just too busy then and there again.
Exactly,
so,
and you forget what you were originally going to ask for.
Right,
so now you've got
and so if I feel like this is focused through the Lord and to the Lord, then it's a perfect blend for me.
Yeah, great. I'm glad to hear that. It can be, absolutely. Any last thoughts or comments on that, on this particular? Kim, yeah.
Yeah, I heard someone a while back talk about getting sun therapy, sun, wind, and air therapy. A lot of times when we're in our practice or our classrooms or offices, we're inside and we're closed
yes.
off from the natural light and natural elements. And so something I've started doing is to walk, to step outside and walk and actually kind of do a measure of gratitude. Thank you for the air. Thank you for the sun. Thank you for the birds. Thank you. How many thank yous can I get through before I go back to my office? And it just gives me that fresh air, fresh sun, and helps me kind of decompress.
Absolutely. Thank you.
A while back I had a shoulder injury, a blocked shoulder, and so I did do stretching. And I found that during the stretching, that was a good time for me to run through things that I was grateful for,
wow.
things, and because it served a double purpose for me, it was practical, so that really worked. But now I find I don't need to do the stretching anymore, but I do it every day because of all of the mindfulness benefit that came from it. So it was interesting. It was driven by another need, but when I saw the effect and impact it had on me, and now when I don't do it in those times, I can really feel a difference in how the rhythms of the day affect me.
That's great. Thank you. That sounds a lot. You Rick and Kim, you both were reminding me a little bit about this sort of positive psychology, as well as talking about gratitude. So there's a lot of, you know, that's sort of another kind of take on mindfulness. And if some of you are, as clinicians, work in that realm, you could easily see how you can incorporate mindful walking or mindful stretching or mindful hand washing. Mindful teaching. I mean, you can get it. But really,
I'll be spreading a germ.
The point being, though, there's an infinite variety, right? There's no one way to do this. You could be, it's a place of creativity, which I think really gives you freedom as a clinician, as a social worker. So I think that can be very encouraging, especially if things are starting to feel staid, or especially in your client work where you want to do something a little bit out of the box, so to speak. Okay, so going back to your question a little bit, Joseph. So this is just a little image. I played around with the arrows, so they're not fantastic. I apologize. But if you think about just religious philosophy in general, you know, we separate out Buddhism and Christianity. You know, we really have a mindful practice in both areas, right? So I talked about Buddhism, the Four Noble Paths. Four Noble Truths. Out of that, the attainable Eightfold Path that leads to enlightenment. That's one side of mindful practice. That's one motivation for mindful practice. In Christianity, we have Christian truths that we can draw from the Old and New Testaments. We have this idea of a reunification with God, so being present with God, being able to connect with God, and forgiveness of sins. And I think there's something there about mindfulness and feeling forgiven sometimes that I would love to hear more if any of you thought of that and kind of put those two together. And then Jesus being the path of salvation versus, again, this idea of nirvana, and Jesus is one of many Buddhas. You know, obviously there's some difference religiously. But in the mindful practice itself, what I'd like to posit to you is that you mean that no one may see that externally, but you may know that's happening internally. So the practices can be similar, but you have a different motivation doing it. So, you know, no one can tell I'm a Christian if I'm drinking tea or not, but I'm doing it in a Christian way. You know, a Buddhist would have a different worldview, and a Buddhist would do it in a different way. It might look the same. We might be drinking the same tea, but it's going to be a different internal experience. And same with your clients, that, you know, you can offer a framework that you're comfortable with, and with their consent, they may experience it differently. So I think it depends on how comfortable you are and whether you want to work just with Christians or people of different faiths. That's up to you. But you can come from a place of integrity for yourself as a Christian and have a practice that's, you know, beneficial for everyone. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, so Christian integration. I really like these people, and this is probably not fair because there's a lot of other people, but these are sort of my favorites. So think about how far back this goes. I mean, I like St. Hildegard. I don't even know if I'm saying it right, but St. Hildegard of Bingen?
Uh-huh.
Debingen, what's that German? Debingen. It kind of goes together. I don't know, Helen, is that right?
My uncle lives in Bingen.
Oh, that's great.
I think that's right.
That's right. There we go. Okay. I will take that. 1179. This isn't too shabby. And I bet there's...
It goes back further.
Even
further.
Goes to
the desert fathers.
Yeah. St. Anthony of the desert.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Thank you. I'm going to add them to that list.
Yeah. So it goes back, to about
150. That's wonderful. Well, that's good to know, and I'm ignorant about those folks, but I would love to learn more. And I think, you know, what you see, and I don't know, you can tell me more about the desert folks, but a lot of mysticism, right? Like a lot of experiential experiences with God. And so St. Hildegard of Bingen, she was brilliant, by the way. She just wrote about everything, right? And I've been reading some of her stuff, and like, man, I feel so dumb compared to her. But she can write about so much. But her imagery about God is very visual. It's very colorful, it's very powerful, and I think she kind of gave us this basis of, you know, this sort of guided imagery that we could start thinking about in clinical practice. And so you, this use of sacred imagery, a lot of people ascribe that to St. Ignatius, but I would go, you know, even back to her. St. Ignatius of Loyola, again, 1490s, Jesuit priest, he wrote a whole, you know, program, essentially, for his Jesuit priests called the Spiritual Exercises, and those are very, again, meditative, mindful. He talks about breath. I'll read this little quote from him. With each breath taken in or expelled, one should pray mentally by saying a word of the Our Father. This is done in such a manner that one word of prayer is said between one breath and another. In between these two breaths, we can reflect especially on the meaning of that word, that sacred word, or on the person to whom the prayer is being recited. When one wishes to pray again on another day or at another time, one should say the Hail Mary, he's Catholic obviously, according to the rhythmic measures. He's very prescriptive, actually, in terms of the breath, but you could see that meditative, mindful practice using breath, using the sacred word. Obviously, then we get into kind of more modern times, centering prayer, Lectio Divina, Thomas Merton and Keating, really talking and developing that. I won't go too much into that because many of you went to Lisa's, and I think she unpacked that really well. But the use of breath, the use of the sacred word, is one aspect to mindfulness that I think we can think about incorporating into our practice. Besides the desert, again, ignorant about the desert folks, anyone else that you think about when you think about this sort of Christian contemplative tradition or Catholic tradition in mindfulness?
Is posturing an important part of mindfulness?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think in my own practice, I think it is because I think body is an extension of language. And it can be really powerful in surrender, like if you're, you know, with hands and palms up. So in my own work with mindfulness, I ask people to position themselves in their body first. Because that sort of does something in our brains. You know, there's that feedback loop to your neurology to open up your heart, open up your arms, whatever it is, but not necessary. I mean, it can be one way. Okay. So just another image. So practically speaking, I took this idea of if you're working with someone who had worry. I didn't want to necessarily say anxiety, but let's just say worry. You know, worry, if we could think about it in this very different way, it's constructed. Okay, it's a constructed reality that decreases with mindfulness practice. Okay, we may not always agree with that, but let's say for us as practitioners, our clients, their worry is constructed. It's not something that's necessarily rooted in fact. So these contemplative skills, what they do is they help lead your client to an acceptance and awareness of that constructed reality. You know, that's a lot of what CBT does, right? We talk about is it an overgeneralization? Are you minimizing or catastrophizing? We're doing things to help them reframe their thought life. Equanimity, hopefully, replaces worry. Equanimity being an emotion and a feeling. Feeling more relaxed, feeling more even is how I like to define equanimity. And then here's where we diverge. From a Buddhist view, it's that enlightened state, right? That leads to a reframed view, that idea of detachment. And again, if you go into that Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, that a lot of our worry is about our cravings. It's our attachment to this world. And so our job is to detach. We are one with the universe. We are one. We're not really, you know, we're not really people. We're all divine. And we just have to realize that. So if we understand that, then we can construct a new reality. There's nothing to worry about. We are just part of the universe. So that's how maybe a Buddhist, again, with a painting with a really broad brush, might interpret those contemplative skills. For a Christian, I think we can think about God entering the picture, right? So God is our focus. He's the one that can reframe that view of worry for us. He's the one that can challenge the Holy Spirit, that constructed reality of worry in our lives or in your client's life. The peace of God that, you know, surpasses all understanding is understanding that biblical truth may help you construct a new reality. So, again, you can approach this different ways. Maybe if you're Pentecostal, then you're going to approach it from a different scripture. You know, but you're going to, you know, it, really it's talking about this idea of, okay, God kind of being in that process. Any questions?
I don't know. I've learned a lot from Dennis Kossel about this. He was actually a huge fan of Ignatius and some, and all, you know, Thomas Merton. So he read from Thomas Merton at the opening session. And one of, I wrote some Merton following that, and one of Merton, who's also sort of a mystic, monastic guy, is that he really thinks for Christians, it's not this detachment, but that sort of, this mindfulness leads to a deeper and more productive engagement with the world. Mm-hmm. That you actually fundamentally understand the world clearer, more in line with God, and you have the capacities to engage fruitfully because of your mindfulness. Which I thought was just an interesting way. This detachment versus engagement.
Very different.
Coming out of mindfulness, coming out of the same sort of set of practices.
A groundedness in the here and now versus almost the dissociative floating.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Which fits from the worldview, because the Buddhist, I mean, the ultimate nirvana is discovering that the world, which is an illusion, is not in existence. And so you want to detach from what is illusory.
Exactly.
So it makes perfect sense that that's the goal. But the Christian, the beatific vision of God is seeing God more clearly. So it flows right from the worldviews.
Exactly. And there's implications to that, right? I mean, I think Lisa touched on it in terms of, you know, in mindfulness practice from that detachment worldview. I think she's right in the sense that it can lead to a little bit more navel-gazing. You know, we get very consumed in our own self. And I think if you're a Christian and if you do have this beatific vision of reality and this hope for the future, you're going to hopefully want to engage in the world. In fact, St. Ignatius would say the whole point of those spiritual exercises is for you to serve others. Mm-hmm. It's not to enlighten yourself. It's so you can be a better container. You can be a better follower of Jesus and therefore give sacrificially. So that's, I think that's a huge difference. I don't know if the Buddhists would necessarily agree with that. I will put that in there, but that's my interpretation. Okay, I'm going to shift very briefly to kind of what I've been doing with this. So in my dissertation work, I have been trying to find a way to sort of test this out, right? Because there's not a lot of empirical studies, particularly on looking at mindfulness skills, especially from a Christian lens. And there's not a whole lot of actual empirical studies in general. So all the studies that I've referenced earlier tend to be qualitative in nature, nothing wrong with that, but we haven't had a lot of quantitative data out there. So my hope, again, lower your expectations. I don't have all of that. I'm still in my quantitative way. That'd be great. I love that definition. Gotta leave them with more. So this is my strategy moving on. So right now what I have is a study going on with Christian University students at Baylor University in Azusa Pacific. And being practical, I have 12 training modules that are MP3 based, and they are based on this Christian contemplative tradition. So the first 5 minutes, I might guide, and we're going to do some of this, so just be warned. I tell the folks through the MP3 player, whoever's participating, to breathe. Then we go into a time of centering prayer. Then we do Lectio Divina, and then I might do a little bit of mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy based on, some truths. I kind of give them a framework, and they do whatever they want with it. And in that, that 12 module runs for 6 weeks. And so it's a commitment. Each module is about 20 to 30 minutes long, and they listen to it twice a week. There is also a control group that doesn't get the modules, and so there's a pre and post test. So They're doing a pretest on what's called the Mindfulness Attention Awareness Scale. Let me read a couple of those questions. It's a 15-point scale by Brown and Ryan in 2003. And just really briefly, so you get a sense, it's a Likert scale 1 through 6. And one of the questions is, I break or spill things because of carelessness, not paying attention or thinking of someone else. I find it difficult to stay focused on what's happening in the present. They just have to decide if this is a somewhat frequent occurrence or infrequent, that sort of thing. And then they are also getting the perceived stress scale. It's a 10-question scale. All of these, again, are reliable, valid scales, have been used quite a bit. I see them paired together. Actually, McGarrigle's study, she's paired them together, and a couple other places paired them together. So I'm trying to replicate what people have done with secular mindfulness, but using the Christian training. And some of those questions sound like, in the past month, how often have you felt nervous and stressed on a scale of 0 to 4, 4 being very often in the last month? How often have you found that you could not cope with all the things that you had to do? And so these are delivered online, and they get those results to me. And here's some very preliminary results. I have 109 folks in this study. I wasn't able to enter in all the data. I was literally working on some of the numbers 2 days ago. And so these are kind of the results so far. For the university students, there is a normative, kind of just an average normal range that they fall under. That none of the researchers give any normative data in terms of this is something you need to look out for if the participant is too stressed. So, but I do have an informed consent. So those are, I think, what's more interesting. I'll switch to the slide because I like visuals. I don't know if you can see those numbers. So the pretest of the mindfulness scale, the mean, I'm having a hard time reading it, 3.73. There's a big standard deviation there. The control is at 3.39. And again, the higher the number on the mindfulness scale, I forgot to mention, the more mindful you are, the more that you're attaining that mindful trait. That's the control group. The experimental group, the mean is at 3.84. So at least the means are headed in the right direction on that one. So that's exciting. We'll see if that actually turns out. The perceived stress scale, this is the pretest on the left, and that says the mean is 3.23. The lower the number on the perceived stress scale, the less stress. So again, you know, the null hypothesis being with this training, you're going to find less stress. Control group is at 3.19. The interesting thing on this one is the experimental group is also at 3.19, so no difference there. They both went down. Maybe there's a placebo effect, but they're both at the same level for now. We'll see. There's more data coming in, but that's sort of, you know, the study that's ongoing. Any questions on the study? Yes.
So whose perceived stress scale did you use?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. This is Dr. Cohen. He was developed, I'm trying to see what year, 1983. Cohen, Carmack, and Mermelstein. It's a global measure of perceived stress. It's in the Journal of Health, so it comes out of health and medicine. Okay. She's quite a bit in health. Yeah.
So it strikes me that one of the things with mindfulness is how authentically you're engaging with the practice. I don't know if you can control for that or not, but it would seem that that would be important to attempt to control for, to say, you know, how authentically, even if it's just a self-evaluation measure, did I actually engage with these mindful practices? I don't know if it's possible to measure that or not.
I did ask the question of how many of the 12 modules you actually completed.
Okay.
So they can report that out, and I can at least look at that data.
Sure.
So some of them did all 12, some of them might have done 5 or 6, and maybe that changes some of the results. But that's one way I've attempted. There's always limits in that quantitative aspect, but that's, yes. Okay, thank you. All right, 5 minutes left. I want to get us to a mindfulness exercise. Just some quick implication. I think we talked a lot about this already, but these are some that I've listed out. I do want to mention, you know, just as clinicians, particularly if you're doing something that your client is not a Christian or maybe they identify as a Christian, but you don't know what that means, you don't want to unpack that, you might want to consider giving them an informed consent, or at least verbally, really telling them, okay, we're going to switch into a mode. I do this with the students when I recruit. This is heavily Christian Christian content heavy. If you're not comfortable with that, you just may want to consider that. And that's just a short way of how I handle that. Any questions on that piece? All right. So here's the exercise. I'd just love you to just follow. I'll kind of walk us through. If you could put 2 feet on the ground, that would be great. Kind of grounds you. If you want to think about grounding your feet, that's wonderful. You can close your eyes. That just helps you concentrate. Again, this is Christian heavy. I do want to say that's Christian content heavy, so if you are comfortable, don't feel like you have to participate. So first, I'm going to guide you through a four-point breathing. We're going to do it together. And so with a four-point breath, you're going to breathe in for four counts. Then we're going to hold that breath for four counts. And then we're going to exhale together for four counts. Okay? Okay, so I'm going to count. Breathe in, two, three, four. Hold, two, three, four. Out, two, three, four. In, two, three, four. Hold, two, three, four. Out, two, three, four. In, two, three, four. Hold, two, three, four. Out, two, three, four. Go ahead and try to keep that breath going. If not, just breathe as deeply normally as you can. The point is just to get breath in, hold, and release. I'd like you to think about breathing in a sacred word or a gratitude or something you've learned from this workshop or this whole conference, something that's sacred of God. Breathe it in, hold it in your body, and breathe out any stress or worry. Exhale it out of your body. Picture the breath in as goodness of God, whatever color you ascribe to that term. Hold it in your body. Imagine that breath circulating through your whole body, this body that God has given you. And exhale the stress and the worries of this world. If you want to pray and ask God for anything as you breathe in, go ahead and do that. And breathe out anything that's distracting you. If you're having a hard time right now, that's okay. Just follow with the breath. Listen to the, sounds in the room. Just continue to breathe. Just a couple more times. Receive and hold. Exhale any stress. What I'd like you to do now is just in the own quietness of your heart, is to shift to a prayer where you just receive. You're not asking God anything. You're just listening. Breathe in. Hold. Listen. Breathe out. Note any distractions. Hold them there in your thought and then push them out. I'll give God that space. If it helps to open your hands up on your lap, you can do that. If you want to bow your head or raise your chin up, that's fine. Whatever gives you a posture of listening and receiving. Take another deep breath for me in. Hold. Breathe out. I'd like to read the Lord's Prayer really quick, and I just love you to, as you take in the breath, keep listening for God, keep listening to His still small voice. Receive God's word. In this manner, therefore, pray, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be Your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth
as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Take a deep breath in, receive God's word. Exhale anything that distracts you. Just notice any words from that prayer or your time now that you'd like to take away with you as you leave the room. What are some things that you've heard today? Some nuggets that God has given you of truth? Your encouragement or gratitude? Take a deep breath in. Hold it in your body. Exhale anything that is antithetical to that truth. Take in again that truth and breathe in as an exercise of, yes, Lord, I agree. Hold and breathe out anything that's not of Him. Go ahead and take 3 deep breaths again, in and out, and you can open your eyes slowly after your 3rd breath. Share any words or notice anything that you've experienced, even in that, I know it was a very short time, but no pressure, okay, but any truth you came back to, a word or a concept.
The shift in, rather than asking, listening was really monumental.
That's great. That's lovely. I'm glad to hear that. Anyone else?
The connection for me between slowing down, and mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And you become more mindful as you slow.
Yeah. You can feel that in your body happening with the breath, right? Mm-hmm. Time is starting to kind of come down. Good, thank you. Well, I just want to thank you. I'm just really excited about just the interest again. I'm happy to answer any other questions. You can contact me at APU or Baylor. I'm happy to follow up. If there's any other feedback, I'd love to hear it. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.